Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Diary of a Crisis, Israel in Turmoil, by Saul Friedlander, narrated by Barry Abrams. In the guise of an introduction. As my editor called it, this text is a cri de coeur. In December 2022, I had no intention of writing anything new beyond what had already been written and almost forgotten. But in January 2023, here I was, busy inscribing daily a kind of a journal of Israeli political events, quite instinctively adding, by association, comments that came to mind and various reminiscences. All this was done on the spur of the moment. Indeed, un cri de coeur. Why? It took me a few days to understand that the political coalition Netanyahu had set up following the election was a monster with teeth that could devour the country. It took me a few more days to realize that each Israeli, those who lived in the country first and foremost, but also those who lived elsewhere and were attached to it, as I was, had to contribute what they could to stop the monster. I couldn't do more because of age and health, but a diary seemed better than nothing. Of course, I could have relied on the assurances given by our prime minister that the liberal democratic regime enjoyed by Israel would in no case be erased, that he was completely in charge in deciding what was allowed and what was not. It was possibly his intention when he promised this, but two elements of the situation made me wary. I knew what political fanaticism was, and I knew that Netanyahu was desperately attempting to get rid of the indictments which could land him in jail. His new alliances would allow him to subvert the judicial system to a point that would make it subservient to the political majority in power, and thus allow him to dodge the sword hanging over his head. Over the spring and summer, Israelis became increasingly aware of what the stakes were. They protested in the face of a minority of messianic fanatics and political autocrats, setting up an opposition that promised to bring a new unity and energy beyond sheer politics to a society that had seemed asleep for many years. However, as I note in this book, the pro-democracy movement was silent on the Palestinian question, which is at the root of Israelis' deeper problems. Then the Hamas attack of October 7th occurred. For Israel, totally unprepared, it was an earthquake. A war started that I describe in the second part of this diary. Nobody knows, as these lines are written, how it will end. 1. On the Brink. Tuesday, January 17th, 2023. It's easy to shout enough when ensconced in California, but it has become impossible for me at 90-plus to fly safely from here to Tel Aviv, 15 hours there and 16 hours back. Yet Orna and I cannot think of anything else. We scrutinize the daily news in Hebrew. We dissect it. We chew it. We swallow it. And we vomit. It reminds me of the German film with Kurt Jurgens, Es Teufels General, about the disenchanted Nazi pilot Ernst Udet, in which, at some point, Udet declares that one cannot eat as much as one would like to throw up. Somehow the sentence stayed with me over the years, and here it is, handy again. Udet apparently committed suicide in 1941. Well, we aren't so far along yet, but how will this end? Last week, Netanyahu's docile justice minister, Yariv Levin, unveiled bills that would allow the government to control the appointment of judges and restrict the Supreme Court's ability to strike down legislation. Who could have imagined that in Israel in 2023, a prime minister would try to overturn the whole legal system with the help of a tenuous ultra-right-wing and ultra-religious coalition to escape three indictments for fraud, bribery, and breach of trust? Mass demonstrations have started against the government and its plans, but will they be enough to compel Netanyahu to backtrack? And if the coalition does not give in, and no new elections are in sight, what then? This diary is open-ended. For the time being, it is just my private chronicle of an ongoing drama that will either lead to a celebration of the victory of democracy, or an admission that the vibrant country I lived and worked in for decades is dead, that something else, something unacceptable has taken its place. Friday, January 20th. 2 days ago, the Israeli Supreme Court voted by a majority of 10-1 that Aryeh Deri, the leader of the Shas party and Netanyahu's main ally, whom he appointed interior minister, could not serve due to two previous sentences for tax fraud and his own promise in 2022 not to seek further public office in order to avoid a felony sentence. Instead, he scrambled into a place in the present coalition. We do not know yet how Netanyahu will react to the Supreme Court's decision. In many ways, the new Israeli coalition is similar to other ultra-right governments in Hungary, Poland, Italy, and Turkey, and to the political program of the ultra-right-wing Republicans in the U.S., Trumpists. But it also has its specific characteristics. Thus, for example, in Europe, this kind of government is in the hands of a wealthy upper crust supported by established religion, the army, and a majority of bamboozled white trash. Intensely nationalist, xenophobic, and more often than not, anti-Semitic. In the case of Trumpists, it is not supported by people of color. In Israel, however, Deri's party is essentially a party belonging to people of color, whose families immigrated in the 1950s from North Africa and the Middle East, who lived for years in dilapidated transit camps and occupied the lowest strata of the labor market. These Sephardim, historically Jews coming from Spain, were looked down upon by the Ashkenazim, Jews coming from Germany and mainly from Eastern Europe. I arrived in Israel from France, having earlier fled from Prague in 1939. It didn't help my parents. I was hidden. They were caught and murdered. The Israeli village in which my uncles lived and where I arrived in June 1948 was populated by German-speaking Czech Jews, the most Ashkenazi Ashkenazim you could imagine. No religion, little Hebrew, and all the habits of yesteryear, even as they were putting down new roots. Israel was not a refuge, it was a country that one called home, or Heimat, if this was easier for you. But unfortunately, racism existed in the new Heimat. Let me be clear about this. Soon after its creation, Israel, consciously or not, became a racist society. For all of us Ashkenazim, it was obvious that the newcomers from North Africa were somehow inferior types. Not officially, of course, not legally, we were not South Africa, but implicitly, practically. We were not only almost unconscious of our racism toward the immigrants from North Africa, but totally oblivious of the existence among us of a small Arab minority living on the margins of the state, at its eastern border, and subjected to military administration by Ben-Gurion's socialist government. At that time, I was working as Nahum Goldman's political secretary. Goldman was the president of the World Jewish Congress and the World Zionist Organization. Politically, he was on the center-left and helped finance various left-wing organizations and publications, such as Simcha Flapan's New Outlook. He decided to make a trip to some of the Arab villages and visit some of the mayors to learn more about the situation. We were warmly received by one mayor, about whom I remember, but what submissiveness! What humiliation! On one side of the mayor's desk was a large photograph of Ben-Gurion. On the other side, a large photograph of the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl. The Israeli demographic majority shifted over time from the Ashkenazim to the Sephardim or Mizrahim, Easterners, meaning Middle Easterners, but the latter's social status did not change drastically. What changed was their political representation when, in 1977, the right-wing Menachem Begin and his Likud party won the elections. Begin had vociferously adopted the Mizrahim, while he himself was a Polish Jew and most of the members of his government remained Ashkenazim. But the Mizrahim felt that Begin had restored their dignity and they voted heavily for him. A few years later, in 1984, the Sephardi chief rabbi, Ovadia Yosef, founded the party that was to represent this Mizrahi electorate, Shas, Shomerei Sephardim, the Guardians of Sephardim. His anointed disciple and successor was Aryeh Deri. Shas is strictly religious and right-wing, and it still somehow thinks in terms of the traditional hostility against Ashkenazim, although Netanyahu is as Ashkenazi as can be. Nonetheless, Derry and Bibi, Netanyahu's common nickname, have one major trait in common. Both have been or are being indicted, the first for tax evasion, the second on 3 counts of corruption. And Shas isn't the worst by any means. The new coalition includes truly abhorrent specimens. Bezalel Smotrich and his religious Zionist party, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, a former Rabbi Kahane disciple, and his Jewish power contingent. I am sure that they will be quite prominent in the following. A major difference between the Israeli right-wing coalition and run-of-the-mill authoritarian governments in power nowadays is the role of the army. Usually the army supports a national authoritarian government. In present-day Israel, the army, including its boss, the Likud defense minister Yoav Gallant, have clearly indicated that all matters pertaining to the occupied Palestinian territories will remain its exclusive domain. Smotrich, the extreme right-wing ideologist whom Netanyahu appointed as finance minister and minister in the Defense Department in charge of civilian matters in Judea and Samaria, in other words, responsible for settlements and settlers in the occupied territories, was blocked by Gallant from interfering in the first case he instigated, the establishment of the new settlement Or Chaim. Netanyahu had no choice but to support Gallant, probably nudged by his own Likud party, and, some contend, by the White House. In his protest to the prime minister, Smotrich was joined by Ben-Gvir, but to no avail. All of this does not turn the Israeli army into a fortress of legality. It is the melting pot of a multi-ethnic society, with the exception of its ultra-religious segment, to which I shall return presently. In that sense, it is a people's army, but its handling of the Palestinian population is often brutal, particularly in the almost daily anti-terrorist operations. It may be contributing to the noticeable brutalization of Israeli society. Yet, in its firm stance against Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, it has created a further difficulty for Netanyahu's coalition, which is all to the good. What I just wrote about the army is incorrect, if left at that. In an army that is among the most modern in the world, some of the infantry units, Netzai Yehuda, among others, have on occasion brutalized the Palestinian population, sounding the alarm among Israeli and international human rights organizations. There is no doubt that this happens, but do not let us forget it happens in the context of heightened terrorist militancy instigated by Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the West Bank and by Hezbollah in the north. Under such conditions, maintaining a thoroughly correct attitude is nearly impossible. Israel's problem is not the army as such, but the decades-long occupation of the conquered territories. As for the Israeli religious parties of today, they are both nationalist and ultra-Orthodox. Liberal Judaism never thrived in Israel. From the outset, Ben-Gurion, quite agnostic himself, accepted an arrangement whereby the religious aspects of private life, circumcision, bar mitzvah, marriage, divorce, funeral, would be enacted according to the rules of Orthodox Judaism. And, most importantly, at some later stage, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, decided that the definition of who was a Jew would also depend on strict orthodoxy. A Jew who was born of a Jewish mother. This was essential for deciding who was entitled to citizenship and the benefits of the law of return. Conversions were considered valid only if performed by Orthodox rabbis. Over the decades, conservative and reform Judaism made some inroads, but only marginally so. In the meantime, relatively moderate Orthodox Jews, Maftal, or National Religious Party, slowly dwindled. As for the ultra-Orthodox, also called Haredim, they are in a bizarre situation, as they do not recognize the State of Israel, but have their own party, Agudat Israel, now merged with Degel HaTorah to become United Torah Judaism, and compete in elections, not because they have become more accommodating, but because they need financing for their schools, yeshivot, and other activities, and for their growing, impoverished population. As a result of these various changes, Netanyahu's administration comprises four religious parties: Torah Judaism, combining Degel HaTorah with Agudat Israel, ultra-Orthodox, but a regular fixture in Israeli coalitions pursuing its own financial interests; Shas, an ultra-Orthodox Mizrahi offshoot of Agudat Israel; Religious Zionist, extreme nationalist, led by Smotrich; and Jewish Power, also extreme nationalist, led by Ben-Gvir. There are still Haredim who do not recognize the state at all and do not cooperate, but they have become a small minority, Neturei Karta. The situation on the ground is actually most confusing, with rabbinical councils lording over Torah Judaism and Shas, and members of Torah Judaism belonging both to various Hasidic groups and the anti-Hasidic Litayim, Lithuanians, some voting for Ben-Gvir, etc. The religious map of Israel is a maze, but one fact is clear for the time being. The demographic balance is shifting rapidly in favor of the religious parties due to the extremely high birth rate of Orthodox families. At the beginning of 2023, 30% of the children in first grade were Orthodox. The mysterious aspect of this situation is the weak presence of liberal Judaism in Israel. I have met quite a few deeply religious Israeli Jews who were the most accommodating, most understanding, and most liberal of people. My first father-in-law, Ben Zion Meiri, who never said a word about the total absence of any religious observance in our growing family, or my very close friend and colleague, Uriel Tal, who, as I will show further on, wrote the most damning pieces about the Jewish religious fanatics. Where did all the liberals disappear to? Why couldn't their brand of humane Judaism thrive in the Jewish state? Why the accelerating rush toward fanaticism? Saturday, January 21st. Much has happened today. Smotrich announced that he would not participate in the weekly government meeting tomorrow, which may indicate he is thinking of bolting from the coalition and triggering new elections. This is, of course, the most optimistic scenario. On the other side of the political spectrum, Esther Hayut, the president of the Supreme Court and the first to take a public stand against Justice Minister Yariv Levin's judicial reform, let it be known that if the Knesset approved the overhaul, she would not resign but would continue fighting. Among the opposition figures, Hayut is the most admirable, while the politicians who headed the previous government, such as Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, have lost much of their authority. Some 130,000 anti-Netanyahu demonstrators took to the streets in Israeli cities, 100,000 of them in Tel Aviv. Sunday, January 22nd. Netanyahu regretfully fired Derry. The judicial reforms will possibly bring him back. Hi, elephant. You have become quite visible. Yes, everybody in the room knows me, and guess what? Everybody loves me. I was everybody's pet for decades, but not as openly as today. Now I mean everything for all those in power and for many other Israelis. As the listener will have guessed, this pet is none other than Israeli settling in the occupied territories. This is a very long story. I will only just begin it today. Let's remember, the ideological and political father of revisionist Zionism, Ze'ev Jabotinsky, pleaded for including both sides of the Jordan within his dreamed-for Jewish state. His successors became rather more modest and demanded Eretz Israel, that is, the whole of Palestine between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, as on the morrow of World War I, the British government had separated Palestine from Transjordan. All of these expectations remained rather theoretical, as between 1919 and May 1948, Palestine was turned into a British mandate by the League of Nations, after they had given contradictory secret assurances to both the Jews and the Arabs, and after promising a homeland to the Jews in Palestine in 1917, the Balfour Declaration, the British became successively favorable to Jewish or Arab interests according to their immediate political aims. Every colonial power was duplicitous in its day, but it seems to me that in the Middle East in particular, British duplicity reached an apex. And for good measure, the colonial office added a huge portion of anti-Semitism. In November 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II and the Holocaust, and after a series of commissions of inquiry and vociferous debates, the United Nations voted the partition of Palestine between a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. The United States and the Soviet Union supported the decision. It was opposed by the Palestinians and the Arab states. I remember attending a huge celebration of the event at the Veldiv, the same cavernous hall in which the Jews of Paris had been held in July 1942 before being sent to transit camps for deportation. The platform for dignitaries was so overcrowded that it crashed. Some were injured. A bad omen. The Palestinians launched an increasingly fierce guerrilla war against the Jewish population of the country. It turned into a generalized war involving Palestinian militias and the armies of the neighboring Arab states, plus Iraq, after the Israeli Declaration of Independence in May 1948. By 1949, Israel had won what became its War of Independence and the Nakba catastrophe for the Palestinians. The 1948-49 war ended, among other things, with Israel controlling somewhat more than half the territory allocated to it in the 1947 partition plan, and with hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who had fled in terror after a string of massacres or after being driven away by the Israeli army on orders from above. An uneasy armistice took hold with, over time, incursions by Palestinian infiltrators and growing Israeli reprisals. In October 1956, a brief war took place between Israel, France, and Great Britain against Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt. The obvious victory of these three strange bedfellows was annulled by threats from the Soviet Union and an angry reaction from the U.S. President, Dwight Eisenhower. Monday, January 23rd. A fundamental and dramatic change occurred in June 1967 with the stunning Israeli victory in the Six-Day War and the occupation of the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the whole of the West Bank of the Jordan, the Golan Heights, and of course, the whole of Jerusalem. Most Israelis considered this a miracle, and some heard the steps of the Messiah, Pa'amei HaMashiach. Some, very few, were wary of the consequences, and Zalman Aran, the Minister of Education in Levi Eshkol's cabinet, famously asked, "Wie kriegt man heraus? How does one crawl out?" President Lyndon Johnson didn't demand the evacuation of the occupied territories. In the Khartoum resolution of September 1, 1967, the Arab states proclaimed that there would be no negotiations and no peace with Israel. Thus, the existing situation solidified and the first settlements followed, Gush Etzion and several so-called military outposts. Even Eshkol, a socialist prime minister, could not resist the pressure coming from the right. Or did he welcome it? The occupied territories became a cancer in the Israeli body politic, and even more so in Israeli society. As my friend Jacob Fried recently wrote to me, Israel did not annex the territories annexed Israel. Tuesday, January 24th. Could all this end up in some kind of half-baked compromise whereby Netanyahu, in order to avoid international difficulties and too much internal turmoil, will rein in his most extreme and unreliable allies? Yesterday he traveled to Amman to promise King Abdullah that the status quo on Temple Mount would remain unchanged. It seemed that he also refused to order the evacuation of a Bedouin village in the south of Jerusalem, Khan al-Ahmar, which for some time now has been a demand of the right. Such a compromise would be a logical endgame if our Houdini wasn't under three indictments and ready to take every political risk to avoid the probable outcome. The governor of the Bank of Israel, Amir Yaron, warns Netanyahu of the dangerous international consequences for the country's economy if the judicial reform is implemented. According to the news, the PM dismissed the warning. In the meantime, the ultra-religious Knesset members of Torah Judaism proceed with an initiative of their own. They introduce a bill preventing hospitals from bringing in chametz food, produced by leavened grains, during this coming Passover. And the whole coalition tries to insert new clauses into the law of return, for Jews only, not, for example, for grandchildren of mixed marriages, quarter Jews. It reminds them of nothing? Half Jewish, quarter Jews? Mischlinge ersten Grades, Mischlinge zweiten Grades. What a shame. Wednesday, January 25th. Hundreds of senior economists and figures from the academic world, joined by thousands of students, have sent warning letters or joined the protests. All of this, according to Netanyahu, is but a tsunami of lies. A previous head of the Shin Bet, the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, calls for a general strike to paralyze the country. Maybe nothing else will help. Thursday, January 26th. The major question regarding the post-1967 craziness and the standing occupation of the Palestinian territories is whether a messianic impulse is embedded in Zionism as such, or whether it mainly characterizes a segment, particularly a religious segment, of the population. Zionism, during the period stretching from Theodor Herzl in the late 19th century to Begin's electoral victory in 1977, was essentially a secular movement, starting as such with Herzl himself, Jabotinsky, Chaim Weizmann, Ben-Gurion, and the major political parties, some of them originally Marxist, that dominated the political landscape. Until the Six-Day War, the religious parties that actively participated in successive governments were moderate and accommodating, Josef Berg's Moftal, for example. But after that victory, they split and one wing became messianic, seeing in the conquest of the whole of Eretz Israel the onset of redemption. As for Agudath Israel, it had no noticeable influence on political decisions and cared about its own interests only. As previously mentioned, private life in Israel was governed by religious rules if and when a person needed to resort to them, but otherwise the religious presence was disregarded by an important part of the population. Now, the newfangled demands of the religious parties have become one of the main dynamics in the internal conflict, and they may have a political majority supporting them in the Knesset. The Messianic Settler Movement, Gush Emunim, the Bloc of the Faithful, was founded after the Yom Kippur War of October 1973 in a meeting at Rabbi Zvi Yehuda Kook's Yeshivat HaRav, the Rabbi's Yeshiva. The meeting brought together extreme right-wing and extreme Orthodox figures, all of them believing that Messianic redemption had started with the conquest of the whole land of Israel in June 1967. My friend Uriel Tal, whom I already mentioned, a prominent scholar of Jewish studies at Tel Aviv University, presented a close analysis of Gush Emunim's publications, particularly of their magazine, Nekuda, Point, and concluded that they were an Israeli version of fascism. They were. Uri did not hesitate, moreover, to compare the policy of settlements in the occupied territories to the Nazi colonization policy in the conquered East. Another late friend and colleague of mine, Amos Funkenstein, a polymath if there ever was one, compared Israeli policies toward the Palestinians to Nazi policies in the first years of the regime. I admit to not following Uri and Amos in these comparisons because I fear that readers, when they read Nazi, read extermination, and that certainly was not what my friends meant. Friday, January 27th. Yesterday, a major operation in the Jenin refugee camp. 10 Palestinians killed, including an elderly woman. Exchange of fire with the Gaza Strip. In the evening, a Palestinian from East Jerusalem ambushes people at the Neve Yaakov Synagogue, north of Jerusalem. 7 dead. Later, a 13-year-old Palestinian kid shoots and wounds 2 people. This is a terrible phase in an endless vicious cycle. The ultras urge a fiercer clampdown. In my opinion, popular anti-Israeli violence can only be kept at a low level by the easing of restrictions on the Palestinian population and negotiations for a two-state solution. The diehards on our side have a strong counterargument. Whereas at the beginning of the occupation in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Palestinian population did not cause major problems, this changed with the birth of Fatah, and more radically so with the creation of Hamas, by Israel in order to create a religious opposition to Fatah, with its lethal mixture of Palestinian nationalism and intense Islamic faith. The demonstration of this dangerous escalation came with Ariel Sharon's decision in
sample complete. Ready to continue?